Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, I'm Lisa O'Sullivan, bringing you another Spin the Rally Pod special. We've already enjoyed hearing Mitsubishi team manager Derek Dauncey's tales from the Safari Rally. As promised, though, he's back to take us through that dramatic climax to the 1998 season at the Rally of Great Britain, where Tommy Mäkinen was on his way to the airport before finding out he had won the championship. Dirtfish.com senior staff writer David Evans has been sitting down once again with Derek Dauncey.
Mitsubishi Rally Art, obviously one of the kingpins of that team, Derek. 1998, we all remember this tremendously dramatic end to that season in Rally GB. Was it Rally GB, I think?
Was it Network Q, was it? One of those.
Possibly, yes. But obviously, I mean, Tommy Mäkinen was leading the championship coming in, I think 2 points ahead of Carlos Sainz coming into the event. So it was kind of winner takes all. But it was huge, huge drama from the outset, wasn't it? Tell us your memories of the run-up to that event.
The strange thing was for us that if we go back, the lead-up to the event was... The season was a really strange season for us. We started the season and we had a terrible start for Tommy, and we were looking for the third championship for him, and we'd obviously bolstered the team with a full season with Richard, so we were trying to do as well as we could in the manufacturers. But we started the season, Monte Carlo, and Tommy retired. He won in Sweden and then he retired in Kenya and Portugal, so yeah. The championship wasn't looking good at all for us. And we got to Spain, and we finished third in Spain. Not a bad result, but still not what we needed to kickstart the championship. So we were like seesawing around, not internally thinking that the championship had gone, but we needed to turn the fortunes around. And France, he retired, and that was a real big pressure. Then it was massive pressure. So we went to Argentina and won Argentina, but. Everything kicked off. We won Finland, Italy and Australia before we got to Rally GB, and it was all to play for. And it was like the embers of the fire were like slowly going out, and then when he got to Finland and won Finland, like we were like thinking, it could be game on, and winning in Italy was the catalyst. But it was a fantastic fight. But just quickly before we got to GB, there's a lot of controversy around the last night into the last day, with the jump start penalty, Toyota trying to protest it, the stewards upholding Phil Short's request for them to review their decision. They basically...
This was in Australia, was it, Derek?
Yeah, Gary Connolly had actually introduced a new lighting system where the lights went out, similar to Formula One, and then you went on the green light or when the light went out.
Yeah.
But in theory, in the regulations, it was the timing clock that you had to go by. So we protested the penalty, which meant that Tommy didn't run. He didn't have the actual minutes penalty that was applied, and we came away with a win. So the pressure between Tommy and Carlos was on from that last day in Australia before we got to Rally GB. So it made Rally GB, super, super exciting. But also, it was, there's not animosity, but it made it a bit more juicy.
Yeah, there's a bit more need there, wasn't there?
Yeah, to try and basically start that event. So even before it shaked down, there was a lot of eye glancing and people looking at the ground, and it was very interesting to watch the body language.
And it was, I mean, in those days, it was, given that, looking at the points here, you know, Carlos was on 56, Tommy on 58. And in those days, it was 10 points for a win, 6 for a second. So it genuinely was winner takes all. You know, if you won the event, you were, regardless of what the other one did, you were going to be champion.
Exactly, yeah. And that, you know, you look at that, the fortunes had changed, and it was all to play for, that event. Absolutely all to play for. And even in the manufacturers, I think we were 4 points behind Toyota going into that round. So, and that's the first time we'd had a proper sniff at winning the manufacturer's title. And I don't think at the time, I honestly didn't think about too much about it. We were looking for the third win for Tommy. You look back at the people that won the world championship over the years, and it was, you know, before the Sebastian's era, Juha's record was what we were trying to match or beat. So going into that event, it was a driver's and a manufacturer's title. But what changed for that event as well? Obviously, we had Richard as a joint number one driver. He's shown that he could actually do really well on that event and possibly win it. So we were a bit gung ho, really, to try and see what we could do. But Toyota had numbers; they had extra cars than us. You felt as if you were the same as Subaru. You felt as if you were not the smallest team, but you know, you felt as if the strength in numbers sometimes can catch other people out.
Yeah, because a lot of the time you would, for a third car, you would have run with the Group N car, wouldn't you? With Isolde Holderreed or some of these other.
That's right.
As point scorers,
who in Nittel Rally Up Germany, we'd call on them to, you know, to support us. So. You know, it worked, but it was clear that when we started the event, we had to be us leading from the front. And, you know, it's really famous. I mean, there's so many iconic images from the event. The first one on the first day was obviously Tommy taking off the right-hand rear corner and retiring on the road section when the police stopped him. I mean, I saw the video, like, before Christmas, and it's still pretty painful to watch. it kind of hurts still.
Yeah. No, I'm sure. And I can't remember. It didn't really matter. You know, this was the days when we had the Sunday stages, what Marco Ellen called the Mickey Mouse stages of Sunday. You know, we went through Cornbury, Silverstone, these kind of places. But you never got to Silverstone, did he? It was the road section from Millbrook to Silverstone where he was stopped. Actually, they'd been to Silverstone before and they went back.
That's right. But I think what to remember as well is we'd gone from, you know, being able to service on the side of the road, we would always have a van before and after each stage. So, you know, you'd have 13, 14 service vans to cover a day's rallying. But now you're into central servicing. So I think when he retired, he still had to do the next stage and come to service. It was completely impossible.
Yeah.
It, one place in the world that you're not going to drag a three-wheeled car down the road is in Great Britain. It would never really happen. So it was kind of a shock when it came in. And the way you know, the way it happened, hitching a patch of oil. If you look at the in-car now, you can still see Carlos having a moment when he went over that same patch of oil. So it was disappointing.
And just a couple of points there. You undoubtedly, you would have had a management car, a service car, or some ability to rebuild the car at the end of the stage under those previous regulations, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. You know, when we would have, you know, six or seven main service vans before the stage. And in theory, if that had happened before, Tommy had come off the stage, the emergency van would be there and there'd be two chase cars, at least one chase car there and one, at least a mechanics car. And the emergency vans had a complete set of everything in there.
So they could have put a corner on the car at the side.
Absolutely. Carry two sets of suspension, a set of transmission, two sets of brakes, everything you think of. So it's because every van, when we worked it out, every van needed to be completely identical. In case you lost a van, you could put an emergency van to a main van, so everybody had the same amount of kit. So, if it was the old days, we wouldn't have even dropped any time looking at the road time that we had between there and going down to Silverstone. It would have been quite straightforward. It was a links broken off, and a cross member. So,
yeah. And it's fair to say that at that point, I think it was the Hellman Imp wasn't probably Mitsubishi's favourite car.
No, I can't remember. Was it a Imp or a Mini? I can't remember which one it was.
If it was a Hellman Imp, it would have really contorted Andrew Cowan, wouldn't it? Because he was a great one for a Hellman Imp.
Yeah, he's got a brilliant helmet in blue one. It's pristine condition. But no, I mean, for me, the whole thing with the Sunday stage is going right back to the very first time I went to a rally when it's St Park. I only live quite close to St Park. It was, it's taking the rally into the masses. So I love the concept of what they were doing, but unfortunately, putting historic cars in front of the main field, it kind of came back and bit quite hard.
Yeah, it did. And from then on, it was a very, very straightforward job for Carlos, really, wasn't it? I think from memory, Carlos rolled though, didn't he? The event didn't play out in a sort of straightforward fashion. All he needed was 3 points.
I think he needed to finish, was it fourth or something in the title?
Yeah.
I think they had Marcus, Carlos and Didier driving for them. And the strange thing was that I think Marcus had an engine failure on maybe Donington on the end of the first day. I think that's it was right. Donington.
Yeah.
And never say never. It's kind of like, oh, could it be that there's more than one Toyota going to have an engine failure? Or, you know what rallying's like. It kind of throws up all the actual, all the issues that are possible. But it became very clear then that we couldn't really do much. It just was Richard getting in front of Carlos and hopefully, in the end, the Fords were Juhar and Bruno Thierry kind of like came to our aid as well. But it really was focusing on Richard trying to do the best he possibly could, giving him the full support. And he drove fantastic. At the end of the first day, Richard was, I think he was sixth. So, yeah. You know, he was there and thereabouts, but he wasn't setting the world alight at the end of the first day.
But, I mean, we'd seen the year before when he was leading and then he had the puncture. He took a minute, didn't he, out of McRae in the fog on the stage that is on the border.
Yeah. Right. Him and Robert on that stage that day, that time before, in the fog, on the notes, brilliant. The pair of them working so well together. Richard trusting what Robert's reading, and vice versa. And when I said to you before about Lassie in the filing cabinet, that's kind of like it was in their back pocket. And that the second morning in Wales, it was icy, it really was. You've got to get through and survive that first stage. And there's some great footage if people want to look back online. There's some great stuff from that second morning, seeing how treacherous the roads were that morning.
Yeah, but they were, like you're saying now, they'd got a lot of experience. They'd led the rally. They knew much more, and they were much more comfortable in the team. And obviously, earlier that season, as we talked about in the last podcast, they'd won Safari. So they'd got the monkey off the back. And suddenly they looked quite self-assured, didn't they? But they had that weight of responsibility to do this for Tommy, essentially.
Yeah, I think the whole team's attitude. There was no one ever that, you know, my philosophy has always been, you know, you ask someone to do something, you're prepared to do it yourself, and that came through from Andrew, Phil Shaw, everybody in the team, you know. Alice Roberts coordinates, everybody would get their hands dirty if they had to get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
I think Richard had some respect for that. There's a lot of things that gone on. There's a lot of things I've thought about since, you know, making some notes for the podcast, stuff that went on, and, you know, Richard in Greece, there were so many problems that he had, and he just bare with us and we got him to the end. I think you're wanting your driver to actually believe in what you're trying to achieve. And as I said before, you know, not just winning them themselves, but they were trying to win it for us. And the pressure was on him big time, but he really, really came through and delivered. I mean, the end of the second leg, he was first overall. And, you know, that's difficult to go to sleep that night, coming back and thinking about, you know, what you're going to do for the following day.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, it's worth pointing out that obviously Colin had an engine problem on what would be his last ever outing with Subaru. But there wasn't just one McRae there that year. There were two. Alistair was in the other, in another factory Subaru, but he wasn't really the same sort of threat, was he, that Colin was?
No, Colin, I mean, it's, you know, there's really, really good drivers. and there's drivers that are just a bit above there. And it's like what you see now with the championship, you know. Yeah. Elvin Evans has come on and made himself, in the A-class of the drivers, absolutely 100%. And all these drivers come through, and it's just whether or not you get the right break to get into the top class. And got a lot of time for Alistair, brilliant driver, never had that opportunity with the cars he drove. Mm-hmm. You know, a bit more experience. But Colin, Carlos, Juhar, Tommy, you know, Harry Provenprairie was basically just about there. Marcus was there, you know, they all kind of knocked on the door and did really well. And, you know, even Juhar, at the age he was back in 98, he finished second at that event. He was a fair bit off the pace in the end, but, you know, it was for the Fords, that was the last time they were, I think that was the last time they ran, they were on the two cars on the podium. But Colin and Alistair, you know, they were stalwarts in the British rally scene. But, you know, that second leg as well, Didier had a clutch fail on the Toyota. So, again, following on from Marcus, we were starting to think, what could happen? And Tommy was thinking about going home, I believe, but stopped for the finish, which was handy in the end.
That was what I was going to ask then. So he, you know, he eventually, presumably a management car, goes out to pick Tommy up from the side of the road between Millbrook and Silverstone. The guy must have been, you know, pretty much heartbroken at his winning running championships had gone. You know, this chance to match Kankanen's four championships had gone, okay, and you know, the potential for him to become the first driver to win three championships on the bounce, that had gone. What sort of frame of mind, what was he like when you saw him?
I saw him on the Sunday night, and it's kind of like we'd almost wrote the season off early in the year. He drove so well. Finland, obviously, no one could touch him in Finland. I think he won that event. I think was it four or five times in a row he won that year in Finland. I mean, that's incredible to think that, you know, pre Sebastian Loeb and pre Sebastian Ogier, you know, the Group A cars weren't as sophisticated as the World Rally cars. And, you know, Tommy was driving really well. Italy was a fantastic result for him. So when we went to Australia, it was his favourite event, and he just knocked it out of the park. So, and this whole thing about running first on the road, he just accept that and move on. So, I think it's like it was like a big graph. It went up, it went down, it went up, it went down. Massive disappointment. You know, that was he drove so well to put himself into position. It's just I think if he'd have made the mistake and rolled out, or, you know, it's a partnership. If we'd had a technical problem and it had gone out, it would have been okay. But it was hard to accept when it was, you know, a patch of oil, and he was the first person to hit it. It was difficult to accept.
He was he is a very philosophical guy, though, isn't he? You know, he kind of rolls with the punches, and you don't get this kind of Latin temperament that you might have got from other people, as we did indeed see from Lewis Moyer at the end of Margam. But he did stay around. He stayed in the hotel. We were based in Cheltenham that year, I think.
That's right. Yep, Cheltenham. That you know, everybody's seen the pictures of Lewis with the helmet through the back of the car. But I cannot not feel sorry for Carlos and Lewis, because it's, you know, you've got two hats in some respects. It's a hat for the team, and you want to win everything you can, but you've got a hat for the sport, and they've done a really good battle with Tommy. And it was, as you said before at the start of the podcast, it was all or nothing with the way the points situation was. So, you know, getting to that last stage and almost being able to roll over the finish and the engine to fail was incredible to watch. We got some information that he hadn't cleared the stage, and Tommy's brother was one of the film crews that was there, and we were already, you know, celebrating Richard coming, you know, finishing, and we got mixed messages whether or not it was actually true that he'd stopped. It was like half an hour just waiting for confirmation, it was half an hour just to make sure that, you know, by the time he hadn't got to the next control, that
he was then OTL.
So, and at that point there, I didn't click until probably about another half an hour later that we'd taken a manufacturer's title, which was you know, for everybody that was a brilliant thing, because whether people bang about on about it or they're just like, you know, they've got it in the back pocket, that the driver Tommy was, you know, won it for three championships in a row, brilliant result, brilliant end of the year, but for the whole team, everybody could call themselves world champions, and big pride for everybody, massive pride.
And you'd taken on, you know, huge teams through your time in the sport with Mitsubishi. You know, Toyota, much bigger budget. You know, Ford, Subaru, really well-oiled machines. And you with your, you know, smaller team, you go back to 96 Safari, you know, a one-car entry, winning the first time you ever did that event. You did it your own way, didn't you?
Yeah, and, you know, I can't praise Andrew enough. I mean, he sadly died early part of the year, but he educated so many of us, the original boys. I mean, there was only 16 full-time staff when I joined. Wow. And everybody else was freelance, and all the staff that stopped back at the factory, you know, they had a great leadership from Andrew, and a way of spending the Scottish pounds in the right way. It was you know fair play to Andrew and Linda. I mean, way the Japanese budget worked, we had Monty Sweden and Kenya the first three events, and the Japanese budget year never started until April. You know, they had the farmers' collateral to make sure that we had the funding in place for the bridging the actual finances until the payments came through at the start of the financial year from Japan. So many things that happened in the background. But as you say, we weren't a massive, you know, we weren't massively funded like some of the other teams, but we tried to spend the money wisely and we tried to be clever with it.
Was there a way, or in any way, did Richard's victory on the event, did it almost get overshadowed by, firstly, the absolute shock of the fact that Tommy was now champion, and then the shock a little bit later that you were manufacturer's champions?
I think it was three hits. It was basically that. It was like, because it was a massive seesaw, the whole event. I mean, you know, everybody's heads was down when we lost Tommy, but like we could still win this event. We wanted, you know, as I said before on the last podcast, it was, you know, Monte Carlo, Finland, Greece, Safari and GB were like key events for the Japanese to win. So, you know, we need to win this event. You know, minimum, we need to come away with another win and see what physically happens. So at that point, I wasn't sure. I kind of completely forgot about the manufacturer's title. So when we got to the finish, it was brilliant. Richard winning it. I'm so pleased for him and Robert. But then, you know, that was the first, you know, that the adrenaline went up because of that. And then you heard that, you know, cars had stopped. And it's like, okay, he stopped. He's got a puncture or be back on the road section, whatever. No, he retired. So, hey, presto, you know, Tommy had won the title, and then the realisation that we'd won the manufacturer's title. So there was a massive party in Cheltenham that night. And if you look at the pictures of the whole teams up on the ramp, but I didn't actually go to the ramp. I was honestly, I'd kind of like hit a wall. You know, when you basically just everything, just all your energy runs out of you. Yeah. I was absolutely shattered by the end of the event. It was just, I don't sleep during rallies normally, but it was just, I don't know why, I was so, so tired. I got back to the hotel and the party was in full swing. And I kind of savoured the moment, a bit of 5 minutes quiet in some respects. It was brilliant to watch the boys. It was, they deserved everything.
But these, you know, these events, you know, okay, this 1998, a rally old Great Britain wasn't, you know, an RAC of the early 80s or late 70s, but still they take a huge amount out of you, don't they? You know, you are so focused, and the emotional aspect as well of, you know, like you say, Tommy going out, then Colin leading and the fight with Richard, and Richard getting into the lead, and then that incredible moment with Carlos in Margam, and going on to win the titles. It's we heard Malcolm Wilson talk a lot about his sort of Super Sunday when Elvin won Rally GB in 17, then Ogier won the drivers, then M Sport won the manufacturers. It is an incredible achievement, and one that that you should all be very, very proud of. But is there a kind of a memory of where Tommy was when he found out? Was he at the hotel? I mean, there was a rumor at the time that he was on his way to the airport because he thought the job was done and it wasn't going to happen for him. But can you remember anything of his reaction?
He was about to leave the hotel. I'm not sure it was finished. It wasn't finished TV. It must be RTE or somebody had got him for an interview. And we were trying to call Tommy, and we were trying to get reception at the time. And it was Tommy's brother that finally got through to him to tell him. I think Phil was trying to call him. I spoke to him as well, and he asked me if it was absolutely 100% true. But I think that must have been like 20 minutes after his brother had spoke to him. And I think he was still in disbelief, you know. I think he must have called a few people, but it was in the middle of an interview and we were trying to get hold of him there. But he was literally leaving the hotel packed on his way to leave for the airport. And he basically got his Mitsubishi jacket out and come onto the podium in the end. But I mean, last stage, what do you think? You think it's all gone? It's not. You didn't expect that to be basically the end result of what's going to happen. So, yeah, it was. I'm sure it was a massive shock to him for sure, and it was a brilliant result for him. He drove, as I said. Sometimes you see championships won, and they haven't really done that brilliant in this season. And some I can look at two or three of them, but he drove so well in Finland, Italy, and Australia that. He definitely deserved to be in the shout for it, and not to be robbed the way it possibly was going to be with the patch of oil on the ground.
Yeah, no, and quite rightly, like you say, you know, from a sporting perspective, you have to say the same really about Karloff. You know, him and Lewis almost count 98 as the one. It's the one that got away for them. You know, if that engine had lasted, you know, another half an hour, they would have been champions.
I mean, the thing as well you've got to remember is that, you know, if you look at a championship and to get to that end point, everyone's done, all the drivers have done all the recces, they've done all the testing, they've been away for like 300 days a year. It's a lot of effort to put in to get robbed on, you know, within sight of the finish. And I do feel sorry for him. Actually, Carlos came to drive for us at RED after I left Mitsubishi for Portugal for a promotion. He came, drove one of our cars with Mikko Hirvonen, and we sat down and talked about that and a few other things. And, you know, because normally you just, if your driver's not with you, you get to say good morning to them, may have a chat with them. But I sat down and had a chat with Carlos for like 2 hours. I think it was 2004, and very, very unbelievably professional guy, but interesting to hear his idea of what was happening with Mitsubishi and telling him what was happening, because it was quite interesting, really.
Yeah, feel free to tell us.
No, it's just basically some of the things that happened over the years, like Argentina, you know, Carlos was really peeved off that we'd... There was one particular stage where you left service and did a loop and come back. It was unusual we did one stage and go back to service. And we just decided, I think it was Lassie said, oh, let's just take, we didn't want to, it was talk about not taking a spare. Let's take a spare, let's not. And we ended up putting, I don't know if you remember, there's like a tractor tire, really narrow. It was half the weight of a gravel tire with the loose. And we put that in, and Toyota thought we were going to go with that tire choice and sent Carlos out with it. And Tommy took 30 or 40 seconds out of Carlos. But when I explained to him we didn't do it deliberately, we watched you leave thinking we couldn't believe it, he was like, his head was shaking thinking that we'd pulled the fastest, you know, the biggest stunt out. It was just by mistake, really.
It is incredible though, isn't it, you know, that how, you know, teams become very insular and you know, this feeling against other teams can build up, and then the rumors and the Chinese whispers and they're doing this and now they're doing this, it really can build. And it's only after drivers retire, and they, you know, I've sat and interviewed a lot of drivers and they've sat down and talked and said, you know, we got it completely wrong at the time. But you're so focused on what you're doing, you can't see anything beyond that, can you?
No, it's really strange. It's like we've always been strong in, if we pick a tyre, we normally stick with a tyre. We've got Lassie, we've got the gravel crews, we've got, you know, Tommy himself. Like Monte Carlo, we were being watched all the time by another team. And in the back for Monte Carlo, you could either go with a narrow tyre you know, with studs in it, or you could go with a racing tire with half studs or four slicks. So, but Tommy was a master on Cisteron. He could take time out of everybody, and the teams would watch what we're doing. So I decided that we'd spoof the team, and I ran out and put the small discs on, which meant we were taking the narrow tires, and they ran off and put Liatti on the narrow tire, and we were never going to go on it. And Tommy took a chunk of load of time out of Liatti, but you know, there's only a few times you can do that before people get wise. But when you explain to Carlos about what happened in Argentina, there was a couple of other things as well. It's kind of like it's not one-upmanship. It's just the way you do it. Sometimes you do it just to spoof people. But definitely interesting talk to drivers afterwards. And I'm sure that there's loads of stories that come out from what they believe was happening and what wasn't happening.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, that was the 1998 Rally of Great Britain. Richard Burns' second WRC victory, Tommy's third championship, Mitsubishi's first championship, and Derek Dauncey, the man that was right in the middle of it. Thank you very much for another fascinating insight. Mega.
Thank you.
A big thank you once again to Derek Dauncey, team manager of the Mitsubishi World Rally Team. And what a way to finish a season. Unbelievable scenes for Tommy Mäkinen and, of course, for poor Carlos Sainz. How must he have felt? And what about the Toyota team manager? Well, we will find out, because George Donaldson is going to sit down and talk it through with Colin Clark in the very next episode of Spin the Rally Pod. Make sure you don't miss it. Subscribe to Spin the Rally Pod through your podcast provider, and it will be delivered lickety-split into your device. But for now, thanks for listening.